To exit the small establishment, he again jostled through a crowd of teenagers loitering by the door. A young man near Andon's own age jostled him back roughly and said, "You're not gonna buy something?"
"Excuse me?"
The teen jerked his head toward the hot hut, his eyes not moving from Andon.
"You take a piss in there and don't buy anything? You don't like fried bread? It's the best in town. Should be more respectful, KK."
"He's not really a KK,"
said another of the teens lazily, swallowing a bite of his own piping hot stick of fried bread and sizing Andon up with an outthrust jaw.
"He's a mongrel, and he's in the wrong part of town."
Andon glanced at the window of the hot hut and understood his mistake at once. In his haste, he'd crossed from the docks into the Summer Park district. There was a paper lantern hanging over the cashier's counter, but it was pale green, not white. He was in mountain territory, and he was wearing a shirt in Caldew Academy colors. He had almost no money left on him, and the last thing his overstretched stomach wanted was fried bread.
"You're right," Andon said. "I'll go in and buy some bread."
He took a step back toward the queue of customers. The first teen gave Andon's shoulder a shove, squared his body in challenge.
"Not in that ugly shirt, you're not."
A smirk crept over his acne-scarred face.
"Give it over. We'll accept it as your tribute to Wylon School and hang it over the urinals."
"I'm not giving you my shirt," Andon said,
but he was uneasy now. Although he was 18, he was still a student with no jade of his own, not yet a man by the custom of his kind. Greenbones, governed by the code of Aisho, were forbidden from killing any family members of their enemies who did not wear jade. Unfortunately, the code did not constrain the jadeless members of rival clans and schools. They were free to do what they wanted to him. Andon had been taught from a young age to never leave No Peak territory alone. Silently, he cursed his drunken classmates, his fifth shot of Hoji, and his own carelessness. There were three of them. The acne-pocked leader, his skinny friend, and the third thus far silent teen who was younger, perhaps 15 or 16, but already bigger and heavier than the others. They closed in on Andon together, falling into natural positions that made Andon certain they'd skirmished together before. The leader in the center hung slightly back. The skinny friend and the larger boy circled to either side.
"Touch your head to the ground and give us your shirt, mongrel," said the leader. "And then say that Caldew Academy is a school of thin-blooded shit-eaters and bastards."
The other boys giggled. Returning with a bloodied academy shirt and a good story of a beating well-delivered would earn the boys considerable status among their peers at Wylon. Andon did not back away, but others did. The entire line of waiting customers shifted to the right like a snake, wrapping around the hot hut and giving the four of them a great deal more space on the sidewalk. The woman taking orders at the front of the counter rose up on her tiptoes and shouted at them,
"Shoo! Shoo! Not in front of the glass doors!"
She waved her arms to gesture them away. Andon used the momentary distraction to attack first. He feinted right, then stepped left and clocked the skinny one across the face in a three-beat. Left fist, folded left elbow, back across the jaw with the right heel of the palm, dropping him quickly. It was better this way. He couldn't run without shaming his school, shaming Hilo, and he couldn't win, not without jade against three opponents, two of them larger than him. They wouldn't do more than beat him, though. Not in public. Not on boat day. Not if he fought well enough to be respected. Andon seized his falling opponent by the shoulders and pivoted, spinning him around and sending him sprawling into the path of the charging leader. The biggest boy came up fast from behind, grabbing Andon in a powerful bear hug, pinning his arms to his sides, while the acne-faced teen leapt over his fallen friend and began burying punches in Andon's sides and stomach. Andon grunted at the bursts of pain. He sank his weight down sharply, kicking back at the large boy's shin and stomping his heel down on the top of his canvas shoe. The teen let out a curse and lifted his foot out of the way, just as Andon drew up his own legs and thrust both feet hard into the leader's chest. His opponent stumbled backward toward the door of the hot hut, tripping over his fallen classmate's legs, but was caught and shoved back by the people he crashed into. The large boy toppled off balance and had to let go of Andon to break his fall. Andon landed on top of him and threw an elbow blindly. He heard it connect with a solid smack. He rolled away fast, but before he could scramble back onto his feet, the boy's meaty arms encircled his waist and dragged him to the ground like an anchor, while the recovered leader fell upon Andon, raining blows. He felt only two of the punches connect with his cheek and ear when the attack stopped and the weight of his assailants was abruptly lifted off of him.
"What do you think you're doing?" demanded a man's voice.
Andon looked up to see a dark-complexioned mountain greenbone hauling all three Wylon boys to their feet. They winced, cowed, no match for his strength as he dragged them together like misbehaving puppies.
"You little shits," he said. "It's boat day. Look at that park over there full of people. There are tourists here, and Wylon school students are rolling on the ground scuffling like dogs. What the fuck?"
"We were teaching him a lesson, Gamgen," whined the leader. "He's a Khal Du brat and mixed blood to boot. Besides, he hit us first."
A different voice, slow but deep, like a bear roused to displeasure, said,
"Is that how future fingers address fists?"
Andon looked up at the approach of a man he had never seen, but recognized at once from reputation alone. The teenagers became contrite.
"No, Gotjen," they murmured, eyes downcast.
The leader said, a little sulkily,
"Forgive us if we've overstepped."
Gaunt Ashentu, Horn of the Mountain, dispersed the crowd with his sheer size and air of dangerous authority. He turned his square chin to look down at Andon, then turned it fractionally toward the Wylon teenagers.
"Leave now."
The three young men hastily touched clasped hands to foreheads as they backed away and fled, glancing over their shoulders as they went. Andon got to his feet, trying to adjust his bent glasses frames to sit straight. Faced with the Horn of the Mountain, he almost wished his three attackers would come back. Andon clasped his hands and raised them in a wary, deeply respectful salute.
"Gaunt Jen."
"You're Andon Emery,"
said Gaunt, his use of the foreign naming convention making Andon wince inwardly.
"The son of An Yurimayada, adopted by the Khals."
Andon hesitated.
"Yes, Gaunt Jen."
Gaunt Ash had a distinctive appearance. He was bald, with thick limbs and a thick neck, and thick jade-encrusted arm guards. He possessed the appearance of a powerful thug, the kind of horn who would bark orders and profanities, who would maim first and ask questions later. In truth, he was soft-spoken, and it was said that his brutish appearance concealed a keen and patient cunning.
"I'm told you're one of the best students at the academy," he rumbled, still looking at Andon.
He turned to Gom.
"A shame you stopped the fight. I would have liked to see the outcome." "I didn't know he was a Khal," said Gom. "Not by blood, but they treat him like one," said Gaunt, his voice taking on a shrewd quality.
He studied Andon like an undertaker taking precise measure for a coffin fit.
"In fact, Khal Hilo thinks of you as a younger brother, doesn't he?"
Andon's heart began hammering again. He knew Gaunt and Gom would be able to perceive his fear, and he breathed slowly and silently, trying to reassert calm. He'd done no wrong, committed no crimes. It would be an unthinkable breach of Aisho for these men to hurt him, no matter how much they wished harm on his cousins.
"I'm sorry to have caused a scene, Jen," he said, backing away. "I got separated from my friends at the harbor and wandered a little too far. I'll be more..."
The horn's heavy hand landed on Andon's shoulder before he could take another backward step.
"Let's have a talk, Andon. Good luck has surely brought our paths together."
Gaunt said to his fist,
"Bring my car around."
Gom departed at once. Andon stood frozen, his mind racing. He could try to run, but it was ridiculous to think he could move faster than a greenbone like Gaunt Ash.
"There's no need to be afraid," said the horn with an undercurrent of amusement in his low voice. "I know you're not a man yet."
Heat rose into Andon's face and blotted out his mounting alarm. He turned his head slowly to stare at the arm Gaunt had placed on his shoulder. Each piece of jade on the man's arm guard had been carefully arranged to form the abstracted but recognizable design of a river. The river was sacred. It brought down water for life and jade for power. It was mild and harmonious, but glutted with monsoon rain, it was unstoppable and deadly. Andon could feel Gaunt's many gemstones tugging at his blood like a gravitational force. He raised his eyes to the man's face.
"I'm not afraid. My cousins, however, might not trust your intentions."
Gaunt laughed, an oddly soft chuckle, as a gleaming ZT Valor pulled up to the curb.
"Get in," said the horn, opening the back door.
Andon suddenly felt weak in the knees, but Gaunt's arm was steering him unerringly into the vehicle.
"Don't worry about the call, brothers. We'll be sure to let them know you're in our company."
With a great deal of misgiving, Andon got into the back seat of the boxy black sedan. Gaunt got in after him and shut the door. They began moving. The driver of the ZT Valor, a ferrety man with a thatch of white hair and flakes of dandruff on his dark silk shirt, pulled the car through a number of side roads out of Summer Park. The car turned onto Patriot Street and began speeding west. Despite his situation, Andon stared out the window with great curiosity. He'd been raised to think of certain parts of John Loon as enemy territory, and was a little disappointed to see that they did not look any different from the rest of the city. Bustling streets and shops, construction cranes, shiny new buildings and muddy old shacks, dogs sleeping in the shade, foreign cars gliding past people balancing packages on bicycles. The ordinary people, the ones who were not greenbones, moved freely around John Loon. So why would he have expected it to look like a different country? He edged surreptitiously down the seat, trying to put more space between himself and Gaunt Ash's bare shoulders, which were massive and densely crisscrossed with raised white scars. The lore of how Gaunt had received his scars was well known, and the man clearly found it in his interest to wear sleeveless shirts that reminded people of it frequently. In the chaos of the early post-war days, a number of criminal gangs arose in John Loon, causing trouble in the streets and challenging the surviving war-weary greenbones. A few of these gangs acquired jade, which was not as strictly controlled back then as it was currently, and thus grew reasonably powerful even as the itches swept through their ranks like an epidemic. A young Gaunt Ash found himself on the wrong side of such a gang, and was one night ambushed and dragged before its leader. Gaunt demanded a clean-bladed duel, but was refused. He raised his bare knuckles and insisted on a death of consequence, a greenbone's right to go down fighting instead of submitting to execution. Gaunt had been disarmed, and the gang members were carrying knives, machetes, and hatchets. The gang leader smiled at the young man's bravado, but stopped smiling once the fighting began. Gaunt's talent in stealing was unparalleled. He resisted a storm of cuts and took an opponent's weapon, then went on to kill all 8 of the gang leader's men. It was said that the gang leader fell to his knees, clasped his hands to his head in salute, and swore an oath of allegiance to Gaunt Ash and the Mountain Clan. Gaunt remained, to anyone's knowledge, the only living man to have walked away from a death of consequence.
"Turn that off," the horn said.
From the front passenger seat, Gom reached over and switched off the opera song playing on the radio, causing silence to suddenly fill the interior of the car and settle uncomfortably into the summer heat that the open front windows did little to dispel. Gaunt shifted his bull-like frame and looked at Andon with steady interest. At last, he said,
"I met your grandfather once, and your mother. It was about 20 years ago. The Ons were exceptional warriors, so gifted I think the gods didn't approve of such power in mortals, and later sent bad luck to stalk them. I was a boy at the time, younger than you, though already a finger. We didn't have the luxury of much schooling back in those days."
Andon blinked and said nothing, taken aback by the turn of conversation. It was hard not to be drawn in by the horn's even and articulate baritone voice, which was quite amicable and relaxed, like that of a very good radio drama narrator, a counterpoint to the unnerving scale of the man's physical presence. Gaunt went on.
"The country was disorderly in those days, growing and rebuilding like mad, but a stinking mess. The Greenbones kept the peace, made sure criminals and the foreigners didn't take over. But in the middle of all that, Ait Yu and Kal Sen had a falling out and divided the Great One Mountain Society. I remember the Ons were among the most vocal in wanting Ait and Kal to reconcile their differences and keep Greenbones united under one clan. In the end, your grandfather sided with the Kals, but the On family was divided in its loyalty. Your uncle went to the academy and became the closest friend of Kal Lan, but your mother went to Wai Lan Temple School. If she'd lived and had her say, you would be swearing oaths to the mountain this year."
Andon kept his eyes forward. His jaw was firmly clenched. What was Gaunt playing at? "My mother didn't have a say," he replied stiffly. "Kal Sen took me in after she died. I owe him for my education, for the jade I'll wear when I graduate."
Gaunt shrugged, a motion that rippled his shoulders. "The Torch of Kaycon is an old man now. You ought to consider whether your debt to him constrains you to being an underling of Kal Hilo."
Up until now, Gaunt's even voice had given away very little, but now it slipped, leaving no doubt of his disdain for the other horn. The car had turned onto a road that was winding its way up into the hills. Lush greenery rolled past on both sides, occasionally broken by roadside stands with weathered paint and private lanes barred by rusty metal gates. Andon tried to keep his growing anxiety out of his voice.
"Where are you taking me?"
Gaunt settled back, depressing the seat.
"To the top of the mountain."
Chapter 9. Skirting Aisho. Lan was in a meeting with Doru and 2 prominent lantern men when Doru's secretary interrupted them, knocking apologetically and squeaking,
"I'm so sorry, but Kal Jen, there's a man on the phone asking for you. He says it's urgent."
The pillar frowned. Perhaps it was someone from the Aspenian ambassador's office again, expecting to sweet talk or bribe him into shifting his stance on the jade export quotas. He excused himself and stepped out of the door that Doru's secretary held open for him. She smiled shyly at him. Lan did not know her name. The weatherman seemed to go through secretaries quickly. This one was especially girlish, wearing an almost transparent pink blouse,
through which Lan could see her black bra. She hurried ahead of him to her desk and transferred the waiting call to his office. Lan did not really think of it as his office, though it was reserved for his use whenever he wished to conduct business out of it. It sat unoccupied the rest of the time. The top floor of the no-peak-owned office tower on Ship Street in John Loon's financial district boasted an incomparable view, but it was the weatherman's domain. Lan preferred his study in the call house. He picked up the phone and took the call off hold.
"Call Jen," said a deep and unhurried man's voice. "We have your young friend, Anden. We crossed paths with him at the boat day festivities. No rules have been broken. We're just having a talk with him. A very cordial and civilized talk. In 3 hours, he'll be released in the Temple District, near the traffic roundabout. You have no need to be concerned for his safety, so long as no one in No Peak overreacts. I am referring to your horn." Lan said, "I understand." He knew he was speaking to a member of the Mountain Clan. No one else would dare this. He suspected the man on the line was Gaunt Ash, though he could not be certain. Lan steadied himself against the desk and made his voice iron in its calm. "Trust me on this. I will hold you to your assurances." "Don't worry about Anden. He's been most respectful and polite. Worry about your brother turning this into a bad situation." The caller hung up. Lan depressed the receiver cradle on the phone and looked at his jade-backed wristwatch, making a note of the exact time. Then he released the phone switch and immediately dialed his brother's house, knowing it was highly unlikely he would find Hilo there. As expected, he received no answer. He phoned the main house and told Kianla to have Hilo call him at once in his Ship Street office if she heard from him. Lan hung up and permitted himself a few seconds to calm down. The mountain's sheer nerve astounded and angered him. If Ait Madashi had a message for No Peak, she could have arranged for a meeting with Lan through the clan's weathermen, or she could have shown respect by sending a member of her own clan to deliver a proposal. Either would have been proper. Abducting Anden, the only jadeless member of the immediate Call family, and using him as a go-between, skirted disturbingly close to breaking Aisho. It put the onus unfairly on Lan to prevent violence. The caller was right. Now he had to worry about his horn. If Hilo found out Anden had been taken by the mountain, his rage would be unpredictable. Lan took out his address book and found the number for Make Wen's apartment. Receiving no answer there either, he phoned both of the Make brothers without success until he remembered that it was boat day and Hilo's people were bound to be patrolling the waterfront and its establishments. He called the Twice Lucky and asked the owner, Mr. Une, to put him on the phone with the highest-ranked greenbone he could find in or around his restaurant. A few minutes later, a man's voice came on the line. "Who is this?" Lan asked. "Juan Nu, one of Make Ken's men." "Juan Jen," said Lan. "This is the pillar. I need you to find the horn immediately. Call either of the Makes if you know where they are, and send any fingers you have with you out running. Have my brother phone me at the weatherman's office as soon as he gets the message. Don't start a panic, but do it at once." "Right away, call Jen," said Juan, sounding worried, then hung up. Lan walked back to Doru's office. He apologized to the two lantern men, real estate developers seeking clan approval, financial support, and help with expediting permits for a new condominium complex, and sat back down, no longer paying much attention to the meeting. He was worried about Anden. The young man was like a true nephew to him, and Lan felt a great deal of responsibility for him. He still remembered holding Anden's hand, comforting the grieving boy, bringing him into the call house, and telling him that this was his home now.
Lan believed Gott had been sincere about not harming Anden, but things might change. The mountain might hold him hostage if something went wrong. Where the hell was Hilo? Doru would have to lack all sense of perception not to notice the aggravation that had come into Lan's jade aura. Sure enough, the weatherman wrapped up the meeting as quickly as possible without appearing openly rude. He promised the petitioners that the clan would take care of their business needs with, naturally, an expectation that the Lantern Men's tributes to No Peak in the future would reflect such patronage. The Lantern Men gathered their papers, saluted to Lan while gratefully reiterating their allegiance, and left the room.
"What has happened, Lansa?" Doru asked.
"The mountain has Anden," Lan said. When he explained the situation, Doru blinked and made a skeptical smacking noise with his lips.
"They can't have planned this. The boy is always in the academy, out of reach. This is an aggressive and opportunistic move on Gaunt's part. But if they meant insult or harm, they wouldn't have phoned to alert you. They must be sincere in wanting you to hold back Hilo."
"Are they truly?" Lan said, remembering something else. Last year, business dealings between the mountain and a minor clan called Three Run had gone sour and turned violent, resulting in the mountain annexing the smaller clan. The story was that two mountain men had picked up the fiancée of the Three Run Pillar's son, driven her 2 hours outside of John Loon, and left her by the side of the road to walk back in the dark without shoes. The enraged heir of Three Run had led his clan in an attack against Gaunt. It had ended badly for him and his family. Hilo often complained vociferously about things the mountain was doing, skirmishes and territorial disputes that Lan left mostly to his brother's attention. But now Lan considered the possibility that Gaunt snatching Anden might be just like what the mountain had done to Three Run, not breaking Aisho explicitly, but baiting their rivals into violence, then sweeping down in retaliation while claiming grievance. The phone rang, and Lan picked it up at once. Hilo said,
"It's me."
"Where are you?" Lan asked. "I'm in a phone booth outside of Gaunt's nephew's apartment building in Littlehammer, and I got 20 guys with me."
Hilo's voice was low, but Lan could hear the barely contained fury.
"Gaunt's got Andy. An informer in Summer Park saw a scuffle break out and said that dog-fucking bastard drove off with my kid cousin in his car."
"Calm down," Lan said.
"I know about it. Gaunt called me. They'll release Anden on the Temple District side of the traffic circle in about 2 hours.
He was almost afraid to ask,
"Have you done anything that might change that?"
A pause before Hilo said,
"No. I have this god's damned building surrounded, though, and it's gonna stay fucking surrounded until I get Andy back without so much as one of his hairs out of place. God's gone too fucking far. My own little cousin!"
Lan breathed out in silent relief.
"He's my cousin too, Hilo, and whatever game the mountain's playing, we can't give them any excuse to break Aisho. Keep our guys under control and get over to the place they're supposed to drop him. The important thing now is that we get Anden back."
Hilo breathed into the receiver harshly.
"I know that,"
he snapped, and hung up. Doru laced his thin fingers around one bony knee and said with a stiff-lipped smile,
"I take it our horn has not yet started a war, gods be thanked. If the mountain is indeed trying to provoke us, Hilo would play directly into their intentions. You're quite right to keep a cool head."
The pillar did not reply. Although he agreed with Doru's words, he found the man's tone faintly condescending. Cold, careful judgment was the mark of a good weatherman, but perhaps Doru's commitment to peace between the clans was blinding him. Hilo might be impetuous, but at least Lan could trust that his first concern was also for Anden's safety. Doru, on the other hand, had never formed any meaningful relationship with the adopted boy, and seemed to be treating today's events like a very interesting business negotiation, instead of what Lan knew it to be, flagrant intimidation. The mountain showing that it could reach into the Kahl family. Lan considered going over to the Temple District to join Hilo, but decided it was more important to stay put in case the mountain attempted to make contact again. "Cancel the rest of the day's meetings. I'll be in my office," he told Doru, then left to wait alone for news from the Horn. Chapter 10. The Mountain House. They took him to the Ait Mansion. Ait Ugantan, when he was Pillar of the Mountain, had fittingly chosen the highest point of elevation in the city to build his residence, and had endeavored to create the feel of a green-bone training sanctuary, like Wylon Temple School, in his own estate. The approach into the property looked like the entrance to a forest fortress, but when Gaunt rolled down the car window and nodded to the two guards, his own fingers, no doubt, the thick doors swung open on silent automatic controls. Andon had never seen a house more impressive than the Kahl residence, but the Ait Mansion was just as splendid in an entirely different manner. While the Kahl home was grand and modern, with both Kekanese and foreign-influenced architectural touches, the Ait residence was classically Kekanese, a sprawling, single-story structure with stone facade and dark wooden timbers, swooping rooflines, green tiles, and wide walkways. It might have been the home of a Kekanese landlord hundreds of years ago if it wasn't for the security cameras, motion sensors, and expensive imported cars in the driveway. The ZT Valor pulled up to the front. Gaunt got out of the car. When the driver opened the other rear door, Andon stepped out nervously and followed Gaunt through the entrance of the house. Two fingers stood to the side. They saluted their horn, but gave Andon no more than a cursory glance. They could perceive that he was not wearing jade. Gaunt pointed to a padded bench standing against the wall near the front door. "Wait here. Don't move until you're called," he ordered Andon. With no further explanation, he strode down the wood-floored foyer and disappeared down a hallway. Andon sat down as he'd been told. Gazing around, he found it hard not to admire the landscape artwork and the antique blades mounted on the walls, even as his palms kept sweating and his insides twisted themselves into knots. Surely he had been brought here as a hostage, to be held against the calls because of something that was going on between No Peak and the mountain, the trouble that Hilo had spoken of last week. Should he have resisted or tried to get away? He doubted it would have made any difference. What would Lan do when he found out what had happened? What would Hilo do? The threat of the mountain hurting Andon or keeping him prisoner might provoke violence between the clans. Was that what the mountain wanted? He glanced around, wondering if he could escape this place, and noticed Gom standing by the door with the guards, keeping a close eye on him. He didn't know all the key people in the mountain, but he knew Gom was Gaunt's second fist and had a reputation as a formidable fighter. Andon remained where he was. A good deal of time passed, perhaps an hour, long enough that Andon's anxiety turned to boredom and then to impatience. Finally, Gaunt returned.
"Come with me," he said,
again with no explanation, and led the way back down the hall. Andon hurried to keep up with his long, purposeful strides. Along the way, they passed two men in suits walking in the opposite direction. Glancing at them, Andon suspected one was Ri Turahuo, the weatherman of the mountain, as he'd heard that Ri was a short man. The other was probably one of his subordinates, or a highly regarded lantern man. Gaunt and Ri did not acknowledge each other. Interesting. Apparently, No Peak wasn't the only clan in which the Weatherman and the Horn maintained a frosty relationship. Gaunt stopped outside a thick, closed door and paused, turning his broad shoulders toward Andon.
"Don't look so nervous," he advised. "She doesn't like nervous men."
He pushed open the door and motioned Andon through. Ait Ugontan had perished without an heir. His wife and infant son had died in the war, buried under merciless tons of mud and earth when Shatarian bombs started a landslide that destroyed the small village that had been Ait's birthplace. During the war, the people called Ait the Spear of Kaycon. He was the daring, vengeful, ferocious greenbone warrior that the Shatarians feared and hated, a man who spoke little but wreaked deadly havoc on the occupiers, only to always escape into the shadows and up into the mountains. His closest comrade, Kaal Sen, was the elder, more seasoned rebel, a shrewd and masterful tactician who, along with his son, Du, distributed secret pamphlets and broadcast subversive radio messages that inspired and organized the network of Lantern Men that became the key to the One Mountain Society's success. The Spear and the Torch. A year after the end of the war, Ait Ugontan adopted three children, orphans from his former village. Advocating the greenbone abilities and traditions needed to be preserved and passed on to future generations of Kekanese, he gave all three adoptees, a teenage girl and two younger boys, a martial education at Wylon Temple School. The girl had undeniable natural talent, despite beginning training late. The elder of the boys, Ait Im, had an ego greater than his skill, and was killed in a duel of clean blades at the age of 23. The younger, Ait Iodo, had enough ability, but grew up to be vain, more interested in becoming a playboy and art collector than a clan warrior. His sister, Ait Madashi, became the weatherman of the mountain. An hour after her father's death, Mada killed the longtime horn of the clan. This was followed immediately by the murder of three other rivals, all of them among the Spear's closest friends and advisors. The Greenbone community was stunned, not by the fact she'd done it, but that she'd done it so quickly and publicly, before her own father's funeral. No one expected the Weatherman to best the Horn in battle. Her opponents within the clan clamored to Ait Iodo, hoping he would return from his vacation home in the picturesque south of the island and stand up to his sister's rampage. The Kekanese term to whisper a man's name originates from the occupation period when the identities of foreign officials targeted for assassination were passed secretly through the rebel network. Ait Mada whispered the name of her adoptive brother, and a day later, Iodo's mistress emerged from the shower to find him lying on the bed, with his throat slit and his jade gone. When the bloodshed was over, Ait Mada sent a message to her father's estranged comrade, Kaal Sen, expressing her deepest respect, her condolences over the recent loss of his wife, her sadness over the unavoidably violent internal transition of power within the mountain, and her utmost desire for the continuation of peace between the clans. Kaal Sen instructed Doru to send a generous delivery of white heart blossom and dancing star lilies, symbolizing sympathy and friendship, respectively, to the funeral of his old friend, addressed to his daughter, the Pillar. In the 2.5 years following, two minor clans threw in their lot with the mountain. The Green Winds clan did so willingly. Its patriarch retired to the south of Kaycon, and its remaining leaders took positions within the mountain. The other was the Three Run clan, which was made to see reason when Gaunt Ash cut off the head of its pillar. The office of Ait Mada was spacious, bright, and cluttered. Books and papers were piled on the wall shelves, the desk, and the floor. Sunlight flooded in from the large windows. The space was divided in two, the office proper and a reception area with a sofa and brown leather armchairs. Ait was sitting in one of the armchairs, a short stack of file folders balanced in her lap. She was a woman nearing 40 years, in loose linen pants, a sleeveless green top, and sandals. She looked as if she had just come straight from a workout or brunch. She wore no makeup, and her long hair was pulled back into a single, functional ponytail. Andon wasn't sure what he'd be expecting. He'd imagined that perhaps the Pillar of the Mountain would be a glamorous and deadly femme fatale, or perhaps a hard-bitten she-man who exuded toughness and iron authority. Instead, she appeared ordinary, except for the spectacular amount of jade running up both her arms. Mounted in coiling silver bracelets that twined up her forearms and biceps like snakes, there must have been at least a dozen stones on each arm. So much jade, worn so unpretentiously. Greenbones had no need for any other symbols of status. Without looking up, the pillar said,
"You made the call?"
Gaunt made an affirmative noise.
"He understood. A reasonable man, as you say. His brother has massed a small army in Littlehammer, but so far, they're waiting."
Ait closed the file she was perusing and tossed the stack onto the polished wooden coffee table. She motioned Andon to the sofa across from her without ceremony. Even with a short distance between them, Andon could feel the woman's jade aura, a steady, focused, red intensity. In the center of the coffee table was a bowl of oranges and a cast-iron teapot.
"Tea?" Ait inquired.
Caught off guard, Andon didn't answer immediately. Only when Ait raised a gaze as formidable as her aura did he manage to say, "Yes, thank you, Ait-Jen." Ait opened a cabinet under the coffee table and brought out two small clay cups. She set one in front of Andon and one in front of herself.
"It's a fresh pot," she explained,
as if it were important that hostages were served hot tea and not stale, oversteeped dregs. She poured for herself first, then for him. An honored guest, particularly a fellow Greenbone, would be served before the host, but Andon did not qualify as either. Andon glanced at Gaunt, who settled his large frame into an armchair near Ait's. She did not offer to pour him a cup, nor did he help himself. Apparently, he was not a party to this conversation, and remained present only as a silent, disquieting observer.
"I'm sure you're wondering why you've been brought here."
Ait did not waste additional time with pleasantries.
"We've taken a large risk in seizing this opportunity to speak with you. After all, there's a chance your adopted family might attribute dishonorable motives to our actions, when in truth, they are entirely to your benefit."
Andon sipped just enough tea to wet his dry mouth. He was more perplexed than ever, but sensed with trepidation that what was happening now was different from what he'd initially suspected, a more complicated ploy than merely holding him prisoner to provoke violence or to gain a concession from No Peak over some dispute.
"I'm told you're the best student at Caldew Academy," Ait went on. "When I was young, my father never allowed anyone with foreign blood to train at Wylon. But times are different now. I'm not like my father. I break from tradition when I see there is cause to do so and when there is gain to be had. I believe differences can be overcome. Disagreements in the past can be set aside. Your lineage is impressive, and even without the call blood or name, you are a representative of the family."
"I'm making you an offer to join the mountain." Andon's heart began to pound. He knew both Ait and Gaunt could perceive his fear, though neither of their expressions changed. His reaction was a sign that he understood what was happening, what was truly being said. Betraying his patron and his adoptive family by crossing over to the mountain would be suicide. He could never accept such an offer, and they knew it. Now, this was a thinly veiled proposition not to him, but to the Calls themselves, to the clan of No Peak, an opening position. The realization that he'd been brought here to be a messenger at the highest level, that Ait expected him to infer the import of her words and take them directly back to Lon, filled Andon with a certain amount of relief. He was not going to be harmed or imprisoned. Then, on the heels of that relief, came a burst of bewilderment and anger at the excessiveness of it all. Why force him into a car instead of conversing somewhere neutral? Why provoke Lon and Hilo to the brink of attack? Why include him at all? Andon imagined standing up, tossing his cup of tea into Ait Mada's face, and saying in a voice cold with disgust, Kaa Lon would never kidnap a jadeless student from Wylon School. The Pillar of No Peak would have the decency not to play mind games like this. Of course, Lon would not want him to do anything so stupid. He'd want him to stay composed, pay attention, and return safely. Andon remained still, keeping both his face and his voice calm as he responded, carefully, I'm flattered, Ait Chen. Ait smiled at his discomfort. I'm glad you understand the significance of such an unprecedented offer. You would be a fist with many fingers, in a position of considerable status and responsibility. But not here in Kaycon. In Igutan. Andon blinked. Igutan? We've established vital new operations there. I need enterprising and talented greenbones to be in charge of our expansion in that country. You would work under the horn, but you would report directly to me. Igutan was cold and desolate. The food was awful, and there wasn't a pebble of jade in the whole vast country. Why on earth would the mountain want to expand into Igutan? Perhaps perceiving his bafflement, Ait lifted her lips in a thin smile. The world is opening up. International trade is flourishing. Why should we greenbones concern ourselves only with the bit of land that is Kaycon, when vast opportunity exists abroad? But what's in Igutan? Ait paused with the teacup below her mouth. SN1 production. She sipped and put the cup down. We're going to sell shine to the Igutanians. Andon was speechless. Shine was both illegal and reviled on Kaycon. It was a drug engineered by foreigners, a shortcut to allow jade to be worn by non-Kekanese, by people without the hard-won tolerance that Greenbones proudly possessed. An entire civilization and culture was built around the inviolable truth that jade destroyed any wearer except the most worthy Kekanese warriors. The Aspenians, arrogant and inventive beyond compare in the world, had circumvented that. As soon as they'd established military bases on Kaycon, ostensibly to help their allies defend and rebuild after the Many Nations War, they'd gone to work in secret labs to determine how their own soldiers could acquire the same legendary jade ability as Greenbones. 10 years ago, they'd succeeded, albeit imperfectly, by creating SN1. The formula of the experimental serum had leaked from Aspenian military bases on Kaycon, and the illegal shine trade ballooned. Apparently, a lot of people, here and overseas, were willing to trade years of life for a dangerous drug that allowed them to wear jade without being Kekanese, without putting in the years of hard training, and without dying horrible deaths from the itches. Less acknowledged and universally scorned was the fact that there were some greenbones who secretly used it too, to artificially enhance their own natural jade tolerance. SN1 was a contentious topic among greenbones. Andon had heard arguments at school on occasion, and even a debate in the Call House once, with some firmly of the opinion that the drug was an unmitigated social ill and others contending that limited use was acceptable so long as it was by sanctioned, highly trained individuals, such as Greenbones, who might, due to illness or injury, for example, benefit from medicinal use to temporarily bolster tolerance. Andon wasn't sure which side of the issue he fell on, especially given his own family history. Nevertheless, in his experience, the one thing everyone agreed upon was that the illegal spread of Shine violated Greenbone interests and values and had to be eradicated. The fact that Ait Mada, the pillar of the largest Greenbone clan in Kaecon, was planning to sell Shine was so astounding to Andon that when he was able to speak again, he forgot his role and his caution and blurted, "You're going to give more foreigners the ability to wear jade? Isn't that exactly what we don't want?" He realized his outburst had probably come across as disrespectful, but Ait seemed amused. "What we don't want is to lose control. The Aspenians already use SN1 on their own soldiers. Other countries will aspire to follow suit. Soon there will be an expanding population of foreigners wearing jade." Ait leaned forward. Andon didn't mean to, but he leaned away. The woman's jade aura and her straightforward gaze felt like solid surfaces pushing implacably outward. "This could be the greatest threat we've ever faced, or an unparalleled opportunity. The faster Kaecon speeds toward modernization, the more vital it is that Greenbones take strict control of our own resources. We can be driven out of our rightful place, or we can stand to profit greatly. My father strived to keep the foreigners out, but let's accept reality. They're here to stay. Kaecon is no longer a mysterious backwater of civilization. People around the world know about jade, and thanks to the invention of SN1, now they can have it. Rather than try to fight the inevitable, let's give them what they want, at a price we control, under conditions we control. The Shine trade on Kaecon has given us better knowledge of SN1 production than anyone beside the Aspenians, and we can ensure the security of the facilities we establish. If we develop the SN1 supply, then we decide the extent to which jade can be used by outsiders." Andon felt entirely out of his depth. He made himself sit forward, reach for his teacup, and swallow down the now lukewarm liquid. In doing so, the proximity of Ait's jade prickled his perception for an instant. The pillar's tone was pleasant, but firm. She didn't sound threatening, but he sensed menace, a dogged avariciousness. "Greenbones were once united against foreign threats. It's time we were that way again. Time that the clans came together in a new alliance. That's why I'm proposing that you join us. The rewards would be great for you." Ait sat back, and her expression shifted, became flat and chilling. "If you spurn the hand we're holding out to you, well, that is your choice, of course. Just remember we're extending this offer in good faith and complete honesty. I strongly urge you to reciprocate that respect by not taking some position in the future that might place us at odds with each other." Andon's pulse was racing, and he shifted uneasily in his chair, his neck hot. Ait was making the proposal as clear as if she were sitting here speaking directly to another pillar. "Ait-Chen." He cleared his throat. The near certainty that he would be returned in one piece to deliver Ait's pronouncements to No Peak gave him the courage to speak up with more force than he had before. "May I ask a candid question?" Ait raised her eyebrows.
"Please do. I'm only a student, so forgive me if I don't understand, but why go to the trouble and risk of bringing me here and involving me in this conversation? If you want to propose an alliance with No Peak, why don't you do so directly?"
Ait smiled a satisfied, enigmatic smile that held no real warmth.
"You sell yourself short.
My offer to you personally is quite real. You have an important future role to play in ensuring peace between our clans, if your pillar recognizes so. As for conversing with the calls, she opened her hands in a gesture of helpless disappointment. I would welcome a discussion with Kaul Lan, but how is that possible when his horn keeps giving offense against us? He never passes up an opportunity to harass us over territorial lines. His fingers spy on us. His fists pick battles over minor disputes. How are we supposed to expect a reasonable dialogue with no peak?
For the first time during the entire conversation, Ait Mata glanced at her horn. She and Gaunt shared a brief, silent exchange before she turned back to Andon.
If the pillar gave us some sign that he was serious about peace, then that would be a different matter.
Ait stood up, smoothly and casually. Gaunt rose as well, and Andon followed suit at once. Ait was taller than he'd expected. Andon was taller than most Kekanese, and her eyes were on a level with his. The sunlight struck the coils of jade on her arms and lit the steel settings with motes of light.
We've taken enough of your time this afternoon. Let's get you home before anyone misses you too much.
A touch of the sardonic in both her voice and the movement of her mouth.
You have our offer. You know what to do next. I'll wait for an answer, but not for long.
Andon clasped his hands and touched them to his forehead.
Ait Jen.
Chapter 11. Where the Pillar Stands. The ZT Valor pulled over to the side of the curved boulevard and let Andon out in front of the wide green space next to the handicraft market plaza in the Temple District. As soon as Andon stepped out of the car, he saw his cousin Hilo waiting for him, a posse of men behind him. Hilo's face was flushed with relief and murderous intent, and for one ridiculous second, Andon was afraid for Gaunt's driver. He shut the back door of the vehicle quickly, and the ZT Valor took off at once, losing itself in traffic as it sped back across territorial lines. Hilo stood up, seized Andon by the back of the neck, and shook him roughly.
I ought to give you another beating. What the fuck were you doing in Summer Park? You're gonna be green in less than a year. You have to pay attention every fucking second, because I can't always be there if there's trouble. Understand?
Andon nodded, shamefaced. Hilo grasped the younger man's chin in his hands, eyes narrowing dangerously at the swollen bruise on Andon's cheek that the trio of Wylon boys had given him as a souvenir of his careless wandering.
They do this to you? He asked. Gaunt or his men knock you around at all?
No, no, it wasn't them,
Andon said hastily.
That was just a stupid thing that happened with some Wylon guys earlier. Gaunt's people didn't touch me.
Hilo searched the teenager's face for sincerity. Then, finally relaxing, embraced Andon with a warmth that melted the last of the tension.
Am I ever glad to see you, cousin?
With one hand resting protectively between Andon's shoulder blades, he walked them over to the Duchess, which was parked quite prominently in the plaza's loading zone, along with two other no-peak vehicles. Maktar was leaning restlessly against the trunk, but straightened up to open the car door for them.
I need to talk to Lan, Andon said a bit weakly as they got in.
Now that he was safe, the low level of adrenaline that had been flowing through him for the past few hours was draining out like gutter runoff after a heavy rain, leaving him shaky.
Lan's in the weatherman's office, Hilo said.
It took only 10 minutes to get to Ship Street. When they arrived, Hilo gave some brief instructions to his men.
Go tell the guys in Littlehammer to clear off.
Then he and Tar walked with Andon straight through the lobby without bothering to check in at the reception desk. Andon had never been in the weatherman's building before. This was a side of the clan he knew little about, and he was intimidated by all the luckbringers in pressed suits, carrying briefcases and file folders.
Hilo and Tar, with their sleeves and collars loose and sweaty from waiting in the sun, moonblades still slung over their shoulders and talon knives sheathed at their waists, seemed out of place here. People paused and looked over as they passed.